And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and the daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them, wives of all which they chose. There were giants, Nephilim, in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old men of renown. Just who were they? The Nephilim, the giants. Where did they come from? In a moment, our guest, Patrick Caron. We go live to Scotland. Maybe we'll get some answers. Patrick Caron was born in Dublin in 1952. He became interested in Bible prophecy concerning the end times around 1996. And in 1997, his first book, Apocalypse Soon, was published and became a bestseller in Ireland. And then he followed up with Apocalypse 2000. Patrick's latest book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, which Patrick believes is the first ever book proving overwhelmingly who built the pyramids and why. Patrick has a Bachelor of Science degree and an MA in Business Studies from Trinity College in Dublin and a Bachelor of Theology degree from the College of Biblical Research, Rome City, Indiana. Patrick is not associated with any particular church or denomination, and he is our special guest tonight at Coast to Coast. Hello, Patrick. How are you?
The top of the morning to you, George, from the Emerald Isle.
Good to talk with you. Yeah, I thought you were going to be in Scotland. You're in Ireland now, huh?
No, I'm in Ireland. They're our first cousins over there. I'll forgive you that for that little slip-up.
Boy, do you have a brogue, by the way.
Well, listen, George, if y'all want me to speak in American, I can speak in American.
Yeah, you just speak the way you are. It sounds great to me, Patrick.
All right.
Tell me a little bit more about how you really became interested in biblical prophecy.
Well, I had, back in 1976, I was in college. I had long blonde hair. I was into sort of sex, drugs, rock and roll, the usual stuff. Mm-hmm. I'd been to America in 73 and 74 as a student working. And I met some people over there, some old hippies who are Christians, and they gave me a Bible, and I started reading it when I came home. And one night, early in 76, I had been reading the Old Testament and so-and-so begat so-and-so and all that. It meant nothing to me. And, you know, about a year and a half later, in the spring of 76, I went up and I started reading Matthew. And I said, okay, God, if you're there, show me something. This is supposed to be your word. And a few hours later, the penny began to drop. The jigsaw puzzle began to fit together. And I had a Saul on the road to Damascus type of epiphany. I didn't go blind and fall off my horse, but I wasn't too far behind it. And that night, I just almost went through the roof. I gave my life to God. I'm sure my eyes were like saucers. I shook. I had a conversion. I saw the light. Call it what you will. And it changed my life.
Well, go ahead, Patrick. Go ahead.
And I started a Christian walk then. I got a lot of people interested, including my family became Christians, a lot of my friends. But I didn't know anything about end times prophecy or the apocalypse or Book of Revelation until about 9, 10 years ago, George. And then when I did start reading books about it by people like Hal Lindsey and Dwight Pentecost and Dave Hunt and these things like this, it made the hair stand up in the back of my neck, what little hair I have left, because I'm a little follicly challenged, you might say. And I wanted to make it known to the ordinary man in the street. So I said, okay, what will I do? I prayed about it, and I ended up writing this very short, snappy little book, short book called Apocalypse Soon. I got an interview on the national airwaves here in Ireland, and the guy gave me a great interview, and he said he read the book in one sitting, and he was gripped. And it went into the bestsellers after that. And then a publisher asked me to do a second one, and I did that. They wouldn't let me on the national airwaves anymore over here for that one, or my third book. But this third book, The Nephilim, that's spelled N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M, this is really radical, George. And I became interested in this because I was interested in the pyramids and all these ancient monuments and books like Fingerprints of the Gods and Gods of the New Millennium and the Orion Mystery and all that. And I was in Turkey a number of years ago with my wife and three beautiful daughters. And we were in Ephesus, which has the remains of the temple of Diana of the Ephesians, or Artemis there. It was one of the seven wonders of the world one time. And we also went to see a temple not too far away called the Temple of Apollo in Didyma. And I was looking at this thing, and it looks like a typical Greek temple, George. Now, it's sort of broken down, but they have drawings of it there. And it had these huge big columns that you see on Greek temples, about 70 feet high. In front of the temple, there were 10. There was 10 of these across the front and 5 deep. In other words, there was 50 of these huge columns, one right beside the other.
And how old were they, Patrick?
Pardon?
How old were they?
Well, the people there told me it was 600 or 1600 BC, but I don't think they know. Right? I think they're guessing. They could be 2600 BC for
sure.
All they know, because, you know, there wasn't somebody there with a video camera and the New York Times with the date on it to take a picture and say, well, this is when it was built.
Or even earlier.
Absolutely. And when you look at the actual temple itself, it was made out of this black granite. You couldn't get a blade of a knife through the cracks. And I remember saying to my wife and girls, I said, there is no way guys with hammers and chisels built these things. And these things are all over the place. In Greece, Turkey, Lebanon, Egypt, they're all over the place out there, George. And this got me thinking. And I knew a little bit about the Nephilim from Genesis 6. I started thinking about it, started reading about it. Then I had been reading books like Fingerprints of the Gods, as I say, by Graham Hancock. And he sold 5.5 million copies of it.
Right, and great theories, too.
Yes, but he hasn't a clue who built the pyramids. So what I've done is I've taken a lot of information that all these other esteemed authors have put together, like the mathematical stuff, the size of the stones, the astronomical alignments, where they are in the world, etc., etc. And I provide the last few bits of the jigsaw puzzle to show who these people were, where they came from, where they got their incredible mathematical knowledge, their engineering feats, the incredible strength to construct these things. Not only where they came from, but why they chose the pyramid shape, because the Great Pyramid of Egypt is the focus of my book.
Patrick, I got to tell you, since I was a young boy, I mean, I was fascinated with the pyramids, yet I never believed that they built them conventionally. And when people would say that the Egyptians made them, I always would say to myself, no, there's something going on here. Maybe they were helpers. Maybe they were there, but there's some other intelligence behind this, because there's no possible way human beings could move stones like it. You're talking about over, what, 2 million blocks of stone?
Absolutely, from 2 to 2.3 million blocks. And you've hit the nail on the head there. There's no way they could do it. There are many monuments like this right around the world. Engineers admit today that we could not build a Great Pyramid today. We just couldn't do it. I got an email from a guy a couple of months ago who'd read my book, and he was a mathematician. He said they still haven't figured out all the maths incorporated within the geometry of the Great Pyramid of Giza. Let me tell you, for instance, that the mathematical solution to how to square the circle is incorporated within the geometry of the Great Pyramid of Giza.
Okay.
Let me give you a few other little facts and figures about the Great Pyramid while we're on that subject, George, just so your listeners can understand. Originally, the Great Pyramid, it was finished in a polished white limestone, so it would have been impossible to surmount way back some 5,500 years ago in the dim, distant primeval past. It would have been white, smooth, iridescent, gleaming in the morning sun, and some legends say that its apex or its pyramidion was made of gold, right? If it was a skyscraper, it would be 42 stories high, which meant it was the tallest building in the world for millennia. There's enough stone in the Great Pyramid to build a 6-foot wall from New York to Los Angeles.
My God.
Yeah. Each side of the Great Pyramid is an equilateral triangle facing exactly to the true north, south, east, and west to within 0.001 of a degree. The length of the base of each side of the Great Pyramid in cubits is 365.2422 cubits, which just happens to be the exact length of a solar year, including the extra fraction for the leap year. The angle of the slope of the Great Pyramid is 10 to 9. That is, for every 10 feet you go up the side of the Great Pyramid, you rise in altitude by 9 feet. And if you take the height of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 10 to the power of 9, you get 91,840,000, again, which just happens to be the exact distance from the Earth to the Sun in miles. The Great Pyramid is situated in the exact dead center of the world. It's halfway between the northern tip of Norway, the southern cape of South Africa, the west coast of Mexico, and the east coast of China, and it intersects the 30th parallel, both longitude and latitude. And as I say, the mathematical solution The solution to the mathematical problem of how to square the circle is incorporated in the geometry of the Great Pyramid. That's just some of the math incorporated
See,
in the incredible
and
engineering.
That, and Patrick, and I've got to tell you, and I'm so glad you're bringing that up tonight, because a lot of people, a lot of guests we've had will talk about theories of the blocks and who moved them, how they were moved. When you get into the mathematics like you just have, it's absolutely staggering.
Of course it's staggering. It's mind-boggling. And you know, historians, Egyptologists, you know, experts, so-called experts, down through the years have said that the ancient Egyptians are primitive man built is. So we're talking about, you know, guys wandering in the desert dressed in animal skin, somewhere between the Stone Age and the Bronze Age, constructed this incredible pyramid, which engineers admit we could not build today. Yet somehow these same builders and architects had not yet figured out how to invent the wheel.
And they somehow knew the exact distance between the planet and the sun, and they knew everything else.
They knew, yeah, but they couldn't figure out how to invent a wheel. Now, that's like saying, George, if you give a screwdriver to a chimpanzee, he's going to make a television set for you. And let me tell you, not far away from the Great Pyramid, just up the road, in a place called Baalbek in Lebanon, I'm sure you've heard about the temple of Jupiter,
yes.
Baalbek in Lebanon.
There's a landing pad there, I think.
Well,
or whatever,
whatever
it is.
But it's got three huge cut-hewn foundation blocks, which weigh 800 or 900 tons each. Now, 800 tons is the combined weight of two jumbo 747 jets together. And lying out on the ground not far away is the Stone of the South, which is 1,000 tons weight. That's three jumbo jets together. Now, we don't have a machine today in the world that could pick that up, move it over, and drop it down. Yet again, we're asked to believe, sure, the Greeks with their little hammers and chisels and their little loincloths on them chiseled away and then threw a few ropes around it and dragged it around. It's too incongruous. The point is there is something else going on.
And it happened a long time ago, Patrick.
A long time ago, some 5,500 years ago, as I say, back in the dim, distant, primeval past. So the Great Pyramid of Giza. And by the way, the Great Pyramid of Giza has two shafts. They call them star shafts on the north face and on the south face, pointing at four distinct star signs, Draco, Sirius, Beta, Ursa Minor, and Orion. And I've identified three out of the four of these with gods, with a small g, which are mentioned either in scripture or in Roman or Greek mythology or in Egyptian mythology, and we'll come to them later on.
I bet, Patrick, that Zahi Hawass, who heads up the Egyptian antiquities, would not like to hear these theories.
Well, of course he wouldn't, because the Egyptians would like to say that, of course, we built the pyramids. But, I mean, if the Egyptians built them, George, then they must have hopped into boats, sailed over to Mexico and built the pyramids there, because the pyramids in Mexico are very, very similar to the ones that are built in Egypt.
And I would assume that the Egyptians might have been around at that time period, maybe as additional helpers or workers, but I'm not sure anymore. It's very possible, and we're going to get into this with you tonight, Patrick, that after they were constructed and whoever built them, if they left this planet, that area might have been empty for years until the real Egyptians showed up, for example.
Of course there was, and it's the same as what they talk about the Aztecs and the Mayans over in Mexico and Peru, and you look at similar structures over there that are just incredible and phenomenal in Sacsahuaman and Teotihuacan and Palenque and all these places that they say, the Aztecs and the Mayans. It's similar. If you go to the traditions of the Aztecs and the Mayans, they will always say, bright-haired blonde people came from the skies and constructed these. These buildings were here long before we got here. But, you know, science will not agree to things like this, because if you can't put it in a Bunsen burner and heat it up and look at it and examine it, then they just won't accept that there might be something else going on.
For us to then really begin to understand these theories, we need to talk then about the Nephilim.
The Nephilim.
Tell me about them.
The Nephilim. Well, as you read out, the first mention of them is in Genesis chapter 6:4. It says, there were Nephilim in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them. And it says, these became the mighty men which were of old, men of renown. In another version, it says, these were the heroes of old, which is interesting. And the Nephilim comes from a Hebrew word, nephal, which means to fall. Now, these were what you and I would call fallen angels.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like the word angel, George, because as soon as I mention that word, your listeners will think of two things. First of all, they think of a little naked cherubim with no genitalia and a bow and arrow going around trying to shoot someone in the heart and make them fall in love. Or else they think of some guy with 20-foot wings, a big spotlight behind them, and orchestral music in the background.
Right. And also people will think that it's spiritual. And though, you know, religion and spirituality is critically important, I think, we're not talking about that in this particular case, are we?
No, we're not. It's, well, look, you know, there's a difference between religion and spirituality. I'm a spiritual person, but I'm not religious. I don't go to mass. I don't, you know, attend any church. In fact, at the moment, I drink pints of Guinness, probably too much. I like the Irish whiskey. I like my Spanish and Italian red wine. I smoke the odd cigarette. I've been even known to break wind occasionally. I'm a regular sort of guy, George. You know, I'd like to think that I'm the type of guy you want to go and have a beer at.
I'm sure you've been to Tipperary, haven't you?
Hey, it's a long way to Tipperary. I'm a regular guy, but I am spiritual. I'm not religious at all. And in fact, you know, the second half of my book is a little bit about the prophecies of the Book of Revelation and the Apocalypse and stuff like that, which were the prophecies of the Messiah. But he was a regular guy, too. If you go on a cursory reading of the Gospels, for instance, you'll see the people that were always hassling him, always trying to back him into a corner, always trying to trip him up, who organized his kangaroo court, his betrayal, his torture, and his ultimate murder were, quote, religious, end of quote, people. The guys with the tall hats and the funny skirts who were up in the pulpits every week. He was a regular guy. You know, if he was around today, he'd be wearing a T-shirt, jeans, and trainers, and he'd be the guy that you want to go to have a couple of beers with. So there's a difference between religion and spirituality. So these fallen spirit men, when you go and study the appearance of what we would call angels, fallen angels, in the whole of Scripture, they're always called men. They're described as men. They look like men. They've been mistaken as men. They wear clothes. They eat. They drink. And apparently they can have sexual relations with women.
So they're physical, obviously.
Well, physical, quote, end of quote. They're spiritual, but they have, I mean, they eat, they drink, they've been mistaken as men. People have told me stories, they've bumped into people where things have happened and they thought these were people, and then they thought later on, hold on, that couldn't happen. They're spirit men. We're told four times in Genesis and once in the book of James, it says, let us make man in our image, and the image of God made he man. So we look like these guys. These guys look like us.
Except they're bigger.
Well, no.
No.
The progeny is bigger. I don't know if they're bigger, but their progeny is bigger. These fallen spirit men, it said, fell to earth. Now, these would be part of the rebellious.
And I want you to explain that for a moment. We're coming up to a break. We might not get it all in, but we will when we come back. But when you say they fell to earth, I mean, I've got a vision of people falling through the clouds. That's not the case here.
Well, I don't know how whether it fell through the fed. The Nephilim means the fallen ones, because they fell from heaven, fell to earth, and fell from grace. They fell from this parallel universe, which is called in Scripture heaven, quote, end of quote.
Okay.
Which seems to be outside our dimension, a parallel universe, perhaps.
Good point.
But they fell to earth. But these guys are men.
So they might have come through some kind of portal, some kind of opening. From these two parallel universes.
Exactly. Some they fell, and they're spirit men, so they're not constrained by the ordinary laws of physics as you and I are.
Could they have been, Patrick, time travelers?
Well, sure. But I think heaven is outside our time bubble. I think it's in a different dimension. I don't know if there's any time there at all.
What if they were criminals in their own place and time, and those people who lived there just said, we don't want these people. We don't want these beings. We're going to send them off to this place. And off they went.
Well, I think these guys came here by their own volition.
Okay.
And there's a raison d'etre for why they did that. And again, we'll get to that in a little while as to why these guys fell to earth, had sex with ordinary women, and produced a very evil offspring and violent offspring who are great in size, thus the giants. These guys were knocking around from something up to from anything from 800 to 1,000 years, which precipitated the flood in Noah. And they so affected and infected the whole of the human race back then, saving for Noah and his family, that Yahweh, or God, said, right, I've had enough of this, and he wiped the whole lot out in the flood of Noah.
Hold that thought right there, Patrick. We'll be right back with you live in Ireland. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Tell you again about The Perfect Possession, the free CD. It's offered to you when you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter. You can call this toll-free number, 1-888-727-5505, to get the free CD with After Dark, or go online, go online to coasttocoastam.com. But the phone number again, 1-888-727-5505. This thing is going like hotcakes, but we've got many, many more left for you, so don't worry. And welcome to Coast, Patrick Kieran, our guest. Let's go right back to the Nephilim, Patrick, and talk a little bit about your theories on how they got here. And then the recording of this information that we've gotten that's in the Bible. I mean, how was this handed down? I mean, how did these people know these stories, those who wrote about it?
Well, originally they were handed down by word of mouth in the oral tradition. But also, interestingly enough, before they were written down, they were only written down around 1500 or so BC by Moses when he wrote the first five books of the Bible called the Pentateuch. But prior to that, for something like 2,500 years, they were handed down in the stories of biblical astronomy and the zodiac. Now, the word zodiac means degrees or steps which mark the stages of the sun's path through the heavens, corresponding with the 12 months of the year. And within each of these zodiacal signs, we have three constellations. And these 36 constellations make up the whole story. The whole story of the plight of man, of his fall, of his redemption from Genesis to Revelation is written in the signs of the zodiac, in the zodiacal biblical astronomy from Genesis right through to Revelation. And that was handed down from Adam to Seth to Enoch, etc. in the oral tradition. But most of that knowledge, that biblical astronomical knowledge, is lost now because with the advent of the written word, they didn't need it anymore, so it got forgotten about. But this is why, for instance, the astronomers in Babylonia, in Persia, the Persian Zoroastrian astronomers knew about the birth of the Messiah because of the activity that was going on with the constellations and Jupiter and Virgo, etc. at that time. They still knew this information, and they knew from this biblical astronomy that the Messiah was being born. But that's all being sort of lost today. But a very interesting thing, we're probably jumping the gun a bit here too, but a lot of this information is in the biblical astronomy. And the Sphinx, for instance, the word Sphinx comes from the Hebrew sphingo, S-P-H-I-N-G-O, which means to join, because it binds together the two ends of the circle of the heavens, the story in the heavens. And the Sphinx has got the head of a woman and the body and tail of a lion. And the head of the woman is Virgo, who is the Virgin, which begins the story of the original prophecy of the Messiah in Genesis 3:15, and ends with Leo, the lion, who's the king. So this tells you where the story begins at Virgo, goes right through the 12 signs of the zodiac and the 36 constellations, and ends up with Leo, who's the king, who's the Messiah at the end. And again, in Genesis 3:16, where it talks about the first promise and prophecy of the Messiah, where Yahweh confronted Adam and Eve and the serpent, he said to them, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. It shall crush your head, and you shall bruise his heel." In other words, it was talking about the bruising of the heel was a non-fatal wound to the heel, which is a non-vital part of the body, which was referring to the crucifixion.
Right.
But it says you, the seed of the woman, is going to crush your head, which is talking about the seed of the woman, i.e. the Messiah, crushing the head of the serpent in the future. And interestingly enough, as I said to you a little earlier, one of the star shafts on the north face of the pyramid points at Draco. And Draco in the planisphere of biblical astronomy is the dragon. And close by that is another constellation called Serpens, which is the serpent. And twice in the book of Revelation later on, we're told that the dragon and the serpent is the devil and Satan. So between the Sphinx, you have the Virgin, you have the Leo, the lion, which is the Messiah, and you have Draco, who's the dragon. And they're the three people who are mentioned when Yahweh confronted Adam, Eve, and he said, "I will put enmity between your seed and her seed."
Do you believe, Patrick, that there is a message in the pyramids?
There's absolutely a message in the pyramid, and I think we'll get to that. At the back of my book, I've written, at last, Riddle of the Pyramid Solved. So not only do I show you overwhelmingly who built the pyramids, but also why they built it and why they chose the pyramid shape and what the pyramid shape represents. But I think we'll get to that a little later on.
Absolutely.
I don't want to jump the gun on that one.
Absolutely. Now, back to the Nephilim, though, because this is just so important. And I want to understand now, when you say they fell to Earth and that they may have come from a parallel universe, did they reside on perhaps another physical planet within that other universe, or was it something entirely different?
I believe it's physical, quote, end of quote. And when you say these guys are physical, again, I would put inverted commas on each side of that. We just don't know what spirit men are, but they ate, they drank, and when these guys fell to Earth, George, they were irresistible to women. You're talking about created spirit beings. They're called sons of God.
Did they die, Patrick?
No.
They did not. Okay.
That's what we were talking about when the break came up. When Yahweh sent the flood, he drowned all the human race at that time because it says they'd become so evil because they were so infected and affected by these violent, evil spirit men that it said there was only evil in man's heart always. And it said Yahweh was just fed up with them, so he wiped the whole lot out. Not just them, but it talks about the creeping thing, the birds, the crawling thing, etc. And there's some other reason for that, I believe, too. But you cannot drown spirit men. So we're told that these spirit men are locked up in a subterranean prison, which is called many names in scriptures. It's called gloomy dungeons. It's called the prison. It's called the abyss.
It's called
the pit of the abyss. And once, interestingly, in the New Testament, in Peter, it's called Tartarus or Tartarus. And of course, this ties in with the Tartarus of Homer's Iliad and Greek and Roman mythology, where we're told that the gods are imprisoned because they rebelled against Zeus. And it ties in with the netherworld or the underworld or the abode of the dead of Egyptian mythology and the pyramid texts and the Edfu texts, where we're told that Osiris is the keeper of the netherworld and that the gods are imprisoned there and you've got to cross the river Styx to get to this underworld.
Is it Hades?
Pardon?
Is it Hades? Is it
Hades,
hell?
Exactly. The same place again.
Yeah.
And of course, this fallen spirit man coming to Earth, having sex with women and producing offspring is where we get all our Greek and Roman and Egyptian mythology from. The gods came down from heaven. They lived in Mount Olympus in Delphi. Zeus came down. He took alchemy into wife, a mortal woman, and she almost died giving birth to Hercules. This is where all this stuff comes from, George. And any historian will tell you that mythology has its basis and its genesis in truth and fact. It's just that the stories have been distorted somewhat as they come down.
I agree with that, Patrick. Indeed, you know some of the work of Zechariah Sitchin, where he has, in his opinion, interpreted Sumerian tablets to be somewhat similar to this.
Well, I mean, the Sumerian tablets talk about the Sumerian flood tragedy. We have all the traditions and ancient traditions speak about this flood that came and inundated the earth. I haven't read Mr. Sitchin's or Sitchin's books, but I've heard about them just since last time I was on Coast to Coast. People have talked to me about him. I haven't actually got around to reading any of his books yet. It's all coming from the same place. By the way, when it talks about these guys in locked up in this subterranean prison called Tartarus, we're told once in Peter that the Messiah, in his risen body, and when he was risen, he had a new spiritual body too. He could pass in and out through the walls, but yet he ate bread, he ate honey, he drank in his risen body. So again, it's a sort of a physical, quote, end of quote, aspect to it. But we're told that he went to these spirits who caused the sin and the wickedness in the days of Noah. And it says he preached to them in this place called Tartarus. Now, that word preach there is caruso. It doesn't mean he preached to them to the point where he was trying to get them saved, because these guys are pure evil, they're irredeemable. So that word preached is caruso, which means he heralded his triumph over them. And that would be the same word that would be used of, for instance, a Roman general coming back from a campaign in a foreign country and parading all his slaves and his treasures before the citizens of Rome. He heralds his triumph over them. So the Messiah appeared to these guys, more or less said, here I am, boys, I'm up from the dead. All your plans have come to naught. Your goose is cooked and I'll be back, or words to that effect.
Is Lucifer in this group?
No, Lucifer is still at large. These are a specific group, according to the Book of Enoch, who fills in a lot of the blanks on this stuff. The Book of Enoch is an incredible book, and I didn't even know anything about the Book of Enoch until I was halfway through this book. And one day I went in and I picked it up and I started reading it and I said, holy cow, I couldn't believe what
Absolutely,
I was reading.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because it talks about these guys, the holy watchers, the fallen ones coming from heaven down to earth. And I have a good few passages from the Book of Enoch in my book, The Nephilim. And the only reason I give this credence, George, is because the book of Enoch is quoted directly in the Epistle of Jude, which is the short epistle just before the book of Revelation. Jude was the half-brother of the Messiah. He was one of the sons of Mary and Joseph. And he quotes from the book of Enoch. So that alerts us to the point that we should be go and check out what's in the book of Enoch. And it describes these watchers from heaven coming down, marrying women, producing offspring, but then they got involved in violence and evil. It says they taught men how to make swords. They taught them enchantments, root cuttings, which is like potions, I believe, astrology and the constellations, the resolving of enchantments, so you're into witchcraft and black magic here, godlessness, fornications and violence, etc., etc. And they so infected the human race at that time.
All right, at this point, let's say the flood has occurred. Have the pyramids been built already?
I believe they had been built way back at the very dawn of time.
Okay.
By these Nephilim, right. By these fallen ones. And again, as I say, I will come to the reason for that
All right.
The second half of the
yes.
show.
All right, but the pyramids were already on the planet way before the flood.
I think so. I think
All
they
right.
were there from the beginning.
Okay.
By the way, there was a second eruption of these fallen angels after the flood, right? There was a second, this thing happened a second time, because you a lot of your listeners will know that when Moses brought the children of Israel out of Egypt and they
right.
went in to possess the promised land, it says he sent in 12 spies. And it says when they came back, they said, there's no way we can take this place. It's full of giants. It says, we saw the Nephilim there, the sons of Anak, which come of the Nephilim. And they couldn't no way take it, it says. But later on, under the leadership of Noah, they did go in and defeat these guys. It says they captured 60 of the giant cities of Bashan or Bashan.
Wasn't Goliath one of these things?
Yeah, that was a few hundred years later on.
Okay.
But in Deuteronomy, when they defeated these, captured 60 of these giant cities, it says they killed Og, the king of Bashan, and it gives the measurements of his iron bed, which worked out at about 18 and a half feet long and about 8.5 feet wide. And as I say in my book, how would you like to wake up in the morning with this guy beside you in the bed, George?
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you. But where are the skeletons for these creatures, Patrick?
Well, apparently there's a lot of skeletons knocking around all over the place, but apparently a lot of these skeletons tend to disappear when they do come up. I've had lots of emails and information from people telling me that there was a lot of documentaries on them. But when these things would be discovered, the Smithsonian or some institute or somebody would come in and they all seem to vanish.
Yeah, there have been some parts found, I mean, like hips and things like that. That has been discovered, and it's pretty strange.
Look, there's a lot of information about giants all over the place, even in Ireland here. There's Sir William Wilde, who was Oscar Wilde's father, wrote two books on the ancient history of Ireland. He talks about Balor, the famous one-eyed giant at the Battle of Moytura. He also talks about a tome down in County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland, which he said contained a skeleton 12 and a half feet long. And it says, here lies Geenan, King of Ireland, Anno Mundo 1786 or something.
Do you remember Cyclops in all the Greek mythology?
Well, Sicily means the island of the Cyclops.
Yep.
And there's all the places, like Athens is named after Athena, who was a goddess. Rome is named after Romulus and Remus, who were the sons of a god. If you fly into Crete, you land in a town called Heraklion. Heraklion means Hercules. Now, all these places, Europa was a goddess, Asia was a goddess.
Doesn't Cairo mean Mars?
I don't know.
I think it does.
The point is that all these places are named after something. Like the main street in Dublin here is called O'Connell Street. It's named after Daniel O'Connell, who was a famous politician. These places are named after people or gods or entities who were. You know, just because we can't see them doesn't mean they didn't exist.
The destruction of the bad, I guess you could call them human beings at that point, can't you?
Yeah, there was the human race back then, and then the progeny of these guys were also called the Nephilim. They were great in size. They were giants. And as you mentioned, a few hundred years later, David fought against Goliath. Goliath was the offspring of these guys. And it says that David's men killed a few other of these giants, one of whom had six fingers and six toes on his hand. So I think these guys were into genetic engineering. I think they were messing around with animals and things like that.
I think
too.
So, too.
Because, for instance, there's a place called Caesarea in northern Israel now. But prior to, in days of yore, it was called Panias. And that was called the place of Pan. And there are niches in the wall there where the shrine of Pan was. And Pan was half goat, half man. He used to get into drunken orgies with his mates, the Sphinxes, and with the nymphs. Hence, we get the word nymphomania from that.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of these drunken orgies, he would lose his temper and kill a few of them. And that's where we get the word panic from, and pandemonium.
Is it possible, Patrick, that some of these creatures were extraterrestrial beings, that they came down in spaceships? I mean, physical craft?
I don't know whether they came in spaceships or not, George, but they are extraterrestrials insofar as they've come from a place outside of our domain,
right,
called heaven, quote, end of quote. So is there life on other planets? Yes, there is. We're told that the Messiah at this moment went to this place. It says he's sitting up there on the right hand of this guy called Yahweh, or we call him God. It says they're surrounded by 24 elders. We don't know who those guys are, sitting on 24 thrones, and an innumerable amount of these spirit men. In one place it says 10,000 times 10,000, which is 100 million of these spirit men, which we call angels, but they're spirit men. So yes, there is intelligent life on other planets. That's where the Messiah is now. That's where these guys are now. They look like us. They don't look like E.T. or a fellow with a dishpan on his head and lights coming out of it. All that stuff is all a deception. This is a place called heaven. And all this information about, you know, extraterrestrials and is there life on other planets and SETI, searching for extraterrestrial life, the answer has been under our nose for millennia.
Yeah,
nobody has just pointed it out and put it together before.
Might they still be on this planet?
The Nephilim.
Yeah.
I speculate in my book, we're told that the Nephilim, the fallen spirit men that caused the wickedness and the evil in the days of Noah, are locked up in this subterranean prison called Tartarus. By the way, they're going to be released again. We'll come to that in the next hour.
That's just what we need to know, right?
Right.
Oh,
but
my.
We're not told that the guys that fell the second time, the second eruption, are locked up. I speculate in my book that these guys are still at large, George. And that's why these buildings begin in the Mediterranean in Egypt, spread out to places like Stonehenge, Newgrange in Ireland, then over to Mexico, Peru, Bolivia, and then on to places like Angkor Wat in Cambodia, where we're told that these places were occupied up to a few hundred years ago. And I speculate that these guys are at large still, and that they're trying to step one step ahead of the onslaught of mankind, perhaps hiding out in some dim, distant forests in Cambodia or somewhere like that.
Would we recognize them if we saw them? Would they stand out?
I know that we've been told that, you know, it says in one place in Scripture, be not soon, always be ready to entertain strangers, for some have entertained angels thereby. So I don't know if you'd even recognize these guys if you bump into them.
They could be walking among us now.
Well, I think they are, and I think that, remember, the fallen spirit men are just a small fraction of the greater number of these rebellious spirit angels that fell with Lucifer way back when they tried to usurp the throne of Yahweh, and they got the boot, as it were. They're still at large. They haven't come into manifestation yet. But, again, in the book of Revelation, in the next hour perhaps we'll talk about it, we're told that there's going to be a battle in the future between Michael and his angels, his spirit men, the good guys, and Satan, or the devil, and his bad guys on the other side. And it says they're cast down to the earth. And it says, woe unto the inhabitants of the earth, because the devil is cast down, and he is very wroth, and he knows that his time is short.
Do you think
him being cast down in the future, and these other guys being released from the bottomless pit, from Tartarus, to be at large again, you're talking hell on earth.
And do you think this is soon?
Yeah, again, I think we'll get to that in the next hour. I think it's soon, but how long is a piece of card? And, you know, the bad news is the Titanic's gone down. The good news is you don't have to get on it. There's a way out. There's an escape route. There's an alternative.
All right,
and
yeah,
that's what I provide in my book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse.
And Patrick's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, so make sure you get to his website as well. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more then on what's the true purpose of the pyramids. I want to know more about these beings that will be released that have been locked up for all these years.